1 year ago today, the campfire broke out. A PG&E power line sparked the fire in the Sierra foothills of Butte County. Strong winds and unbelievably dry conditions blew that spark into an inferno that became the worst wildfire in California history, devastating Paradise, California, and several small towns nearby. 85 people died, 18,000 plus structures were destroyed, and the entire region has been changed as survivors seek to build new lives elsewhere. Author and journalist Mark Arax was on our show this summer to talk about his recent book, The Dreamt Land, about California's Central Valley. Today, he's back with us to discuss a long article he wrote and published this summer in California Sunday magazine. In it, he dug into the history of Paradise and Butte County and the entire state to try to figure out what forces came together to make the fire so destructive. Good morning, Mark, and welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So in your article, you trace the beginning of, you know, if I can borrow a cliche, the perfect storm that destroyed Paradise, all the way back to the early days of European settlement. Can you explain that?
Well, I just finished the book, The Dreamt Land, and I, you know, obviously 5 years I was telling the story of how we had to invent California. We had invented the grandest water-moving delivery system in the history of man, and we had kind of defied nature in a way that no society had. But when I got up to Paradise, it was 4 months after the fire, and I wasn't prepared for what I saw up there. I mean, it was on this little perch of volcanic red earth where gold mining had given way to logging, and logging had given way to apple growing, and apple growing had given way to suburbia. Really, a misplaced place had arisen. And, you know, what to call that experiment? And if you counted the sprawl up the mountain that followed the original sprawl on the hill, 40,000 people were living atop a geologic chimney. And so, you know, I wanted to figure out how that happened, you know, through the decades. And I had four guides kind of taking me through not just Paradise, but the whole, our whole management of forests, mismanagement of forests. And so I begin at the beginning, which is the gold rush. And the gold rush turns into logging up there, and then logging turns into agriculture. And they start growing a community under the direction of Butte County at first. And it's this extraordinary building that takes place without any planning whatsoever.
So as Paradise grew, land use decisions, or in some cases, in fact, many cases, non-decisions, started to play a role. And one of the sources you referred to, four sources in your story, was a woman named Pam Figge. I'm not sure if that's the correct pronunciation of her name.
It is.
She has a background in planning. So what did you find out from her?
Well, Pam, you know, has been a professor at Chico State, but she started as a journalist there on a weekly, and then worked for the county planning office. And she told me, you know, she talked about four by fouring, and it was a term I never heard before. But basically, what it meant was a businessman in town, someone prominent, usually would buy a parcel in Paradise, and the Butte County supervisors would promptly agree to his request to divide his parcel into four pieces. Then he would invariably sell one of those pieces to a partner or family member who would go before the same board of supervisors and win approval to divide his piece into four. And so on and on the slicing and dicing went. So, you know, the number four wasn't arbitrary. Had they split each piece into five, it would have qualified as a subdivision under state law, and it would have required developers and residents to fund the proper infrastructure to serve such growth. Instead, you know, scores of these housing tracts popped up without sidewalks, gutters, buffers to provide a defensible space against fire. Roads came later, if they came at all, and they never constructed a municipal sewage system. It was septic tanks handled the chore. So there was no planning, and it was allowed to grow in the most haphazard way.
And so Paradise was laid out with absolutely no provision then for disaster evacuation.
No, it wasn't until way, way late in the game that they tried, you know, too far after the fact to try to make those there just weren't enough roads, service roads, to move people in and out in the event of wildfire. And they knew a wildfire was coming. You know, if you lived in those hills and mountains, that was the history of the place. Fires went through there. So it was this weird courting of danger, and at the same time, kind of defying the nature of that place, and just living on through it. They weren't unusual. I mean, we have 10 million Californians right now, a quarter of our population, living in the wildland-urban interface. You know.
Mark, that was another question I had for you, because you know, a lot of these planning shenanigans, if you want to use the word, took place in the 60s and 70s, when there was explosive growth of California's population in general. And so I have to imagine that what happened in Paradise happened elsewhere in California. So there are a bunch of other paradises
there
out
there,
aren't there?
I was driving up and down the state of California before this recent outbreak of fires, which are nowhere near, by the way. I mean, you know, the national media played it as California is, you know, paradise is burning again. But, you know, last year, 600,000 acres were scorched. This year, it's 75,000. But as I was driving up and down the state from San Diego all the way up to Mount Shasta, you could see in Chaparral Hill Country new houses being built as we speak. So there's just this defiance of nature that goes back. I think it goes back, in my book, I trace it, you know, all the way back to the, you know, before the Gold Rush. But the Gold Rush, we started in this kind of supercharged way. And that ethos of extraction has never ended. It keeps going on and on. And you just wonder now with, you know, we don't need climate change in California to create these havocs of weather, these disasters. But now that climate change is hitching on to our inherent weather patterns, you know, you have to wonder, is an awareness going to take place that's going to actually change the way we do land use?
Our guest this morning is Mark Arax. He is a journalist and author, was on our program earlier this year for his book, The Dreamt Land. And last year, after the campfire in Paradise, California, visited there, wrote a long article about the forces that led up to the campfire that was published earlier this summer in California Sunday Magazine. So, Mark, the next ingredient, or an additional ingredient you identify in your article, is forest management practices. And in your story, that goes back to Governor Pete Wilson in California, perhaps even farther than that. And on our show, we've had extensive conversations about how our forest land should be managed to mitigate fire. But can you describe the history of the management practices there in the Sierra foothills?
Right. So part one is the development that takes place there. That's factor one. The second factor is I am able to find a gentleman named Richard Wilson, an old cattleman who lives almost as a heretic alone on this mountain called Buck Mountain across the Eel River deep in the Mendocino Woods. And he ran the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection in the 1990s. And he really does a job of explaining, you know, our mismanagement of the forests. And it begins with this, you know, in pre-settlement times, our forests supported 64 trees an acre. If you looked at our forest, there were these large, large, great swaths of the Sierra with only a scattering of trees, a lot of empty spots in that forest. Today, when you go to our forest, it now boasts 160 trees an acre. And we look at that, our eye, and see this mountain-to-mountain vegetation as proof of the forest's good health. But actually, that's not the way nature intended it. And that is what is creating the fuel for these wildfires. And he takes me through, you know, the development of the forest, you know, and the fact that the Indians, the indigenous, gave us the natural forest. Much of it was patchy, and the trees grew to these differing heights. And that combination of open ground and uneven canopy, it kept the fires, the natural fires, from raging, you know, and now the fires are raging. And so the reason is, you know, we have treated the forest almost as if it's an industrialized kind of agriculture, and the trees have become just another crop. And the growth, by taking out all that old growth and planting new growth, which is uniform, you know, when a fire hits it, it becomes a blowtorch, and the trees are matchsticks. And so, you know, he takes us through that, and then he takes us inside the agency that he led during Pete Wilson's time. You know, back in his day, a transition took place. That department had a lot of forest folks in it, foresters. It turned into a department that, well, it turned into Cal Fire. You know, where all the resources then went into not preventing wildfire, to not doing prescribed burns. It went to fighting fire. And we created this kind of disaster industrial complex with all this warlike mobilization and machines to fight fire. We went way too far in the direction of industrializing, the forest management, the forest fires.
And on the social level, you know, you must have this also this effect of California, where you have so many people moving in the 60s and 70s from other parts of the country. They get there, they see these dense forests that have grown now that, as you mentioned, are really not natural, but they look at them as natural because that's all they know.
That's right. I mean, you know, I took a look at these photos in a book that were from pre-settlement California, and I was, you know, my eyes weren't prepared for the forest that they had photographed. It looked rather forlorn, you know, but not today. And so, you know, fire suppression now is a $1.1 billion line item in the department's budget. And, you know, they went out and bought $300 million for new Black Hawk helicopters to replace the fleet of Vietnam-era Hueys that they had. And those cargo planes retrofitted to carry 4,000 gallons of that crazy pink-red flame retardant. And this is the direction we went. And then what you see is that Cal Fire then became the fire department for places like Paradise. So instead of telling these places not to grow anymore, the Cal Fire became the agency that served the growth. And they got funding for doing that. So it became this weird kind of perverse cycle. And, you know, the state of California still doesn't tell the localities how to grow. And this is a problem. So that's kind of part two, factor two in these ingredients that led to this disaster.
Mark Arax is our guest this morning, journalist and author, most recently of the book, The Dreamt Land. And we're talking about an article that he published earlier this summer in California Sunday Magazine about the Paradise area and the campfire. It's called Simply Gone. And you can join the conversation this morning if you would like to give us a call at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Mark, now we come to the elephant in the room. They're in the news every single day, Pacific Gas and Electric.
That's right. So this is the longest section in the story, tracing the history of PG&E. And when you trace it, you come to this kind of sad conclusion that PG&E, almost from the get-go, a century back, was a criminal enterprise. Just the neglect, the mismanagement, the corruption, and how that corruption was allowed to take place by the California Public Utilities Commission, which had a very cozy relationship over the decades with PG&E. And, you know, let's be fair to PG&E. We have asked it to do an impossible task. It is the nation's biggest utility. Its service area stretches 70,000 square miles. There are 100,000 miles of distribution lines, 16 million customers, because we allowed people to go into those zones where they probably should have never gone, and they agreed to supply the power. So great, you know, covering, you know, huge areas of California. But you go back and really where you find the thing really kind of a precedent is you go to 2007, 2008, you go to San Bruno, where that gas line blew up, and it killed so many people and took a whole suburban. That was, I believe, in September 9th, 2010, took a whole suburban neighborhood. And you see that PG&E was supposed to have fixed that gas line, not once but twice, was given millions of dollars, not once but twice, to fix it, failed to do so. That money went into shareholder payoffs and higher salaries for its executives. And so that ethic then plays out in the forests, and they do not do the kind of management of those forests, keeping brush out from, you know, under their equipment that is deteriorating. And this becomes the spark that sets these fires. And that's what we're reckoning with today. That's what the governor is reckoning with today. What do we do with PG&E? I mean, it's shown time and again that it can't manage itself.
So you compared the safety records of the Southern California utilities. There, a lot of people don't know this, but there are different and very big utilities that serve the L.A. Basin and San Diego, and you found some significant differences in their safety records.
Yeah, I mean, the Southern California, San Diego Gas and Electric, Southern California Edison, their equipment had caused far fewer fires than PG&E's. They had done a better job of modernizing their equipment. They had started after the fires of the early 2000s. They learned some lessons from those fires that PG&E did not learn. They had meteorologists going in and really figuring out what the weather patterns were, when winds were coming. They did a better job of taking down the power. Not huge, in a huge kind of way that PG&E did, but these more specific kinds of shutoffs that were for safety reasons. They call it de-energizing. So a better record. They heeded the lessons, although not perfect by any stretch.
And again, to be fair to PG&E, both of those utilities in Southern California have much smaller scale geographies that they serve.
That's right. It's different. But some lessons could have been learned had PG&E just looked south. There was an arrogance in PG&E, and that arrogance was fed by the failure of the California Public Utilities Commission to really intervene in a way that, would have, a watchdog doing its job would have.
Mark Araxes is our guest this morning here on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of the recent book, The Dreamt Land, and also a very in-depth article that was published in California Sunday Magazine about all the factors that led up to the campfire, which destroyed Paradise and some surrounding communities 1 year ago today. So, Mark, now that PG&E is in bankruptcy, where does that leave the former residents of Paradise and the people who lost their homes in the Tubbs Fire the year before in Sonoma, for example, people who lost everything, and that loss is due directly to PG&E?
Yeah, well, there was a settlement. Money is going to be coming to those communities to rebuild. The lawsuits are going forward on their personal losses. And you see this kind of response. It's almost an impulse in California to rebuild. If you drive that Skyway Road from Chico up the hilltop to Paradise, you will see signs planted along the way: rebuild, recoup, recover. The best is yet to come. Don't stop believing. We are ridge strong. These almost exhortations to build again. And, the Chamber of Commerce, the building trades, the churches, the civics clubs are trying to persuade folks to come back up. So what is going to be rebuilt there? Certainly they can't rebuild the kind of sprawl development they had before, and yet no one's, really knows. Will they build a community that will be able to survive the next wildfire? This is the great question.
And there have been no changes in the building codes, have there?
I don't think so. I mean, they were talking about metal roofs and things of that nature, but as I'm following it, I'm hearing more and more folks say that, well, you know, we can't do those things because we won't be affordable, you know, and we need to be affordable. And this is the contradiction of California. We're trying to build 3 million new affordable houses in the state. It's a laudable goal, but into what safe zones they're going. You know, when we built that Grand Water moving delivery system that I talked about at the beginning of the interview, we were 11 million people. We're 40 million people now. The system is cracking. You know, something has to give, and yet California doesn't want to preside over a kind of era of limits. And so this is our conflict, our existential kind of, you know, conflict. And will climate change bring a new reality to how we're doing, you know, building and growing farmland and growing suburbia, even as these things are happening, these disasters are visiting us? That's the great question.
We have just a little bit of time left, Mark, but I wanted to jump in and ask what your thoughts have been on last month's PG&E blackouts that hit Northern California.
Yeah, I thought they were sloppy. They were poorly executed. You know, there was almost this kind of passive-aggressive thing that, hey, you guys have blamed us. You made us do this job. Now we're going to show you a little pain. I couldn't help feeling that. I'm not sure if that's correct or not. But I think it has to become more targeted, smarter, and they have to catch up on years of neglect of keeping their lines clean of trees and debris that can catch fire.
Journalist and author Mark Arax, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Mark's the author of The Dreamt Land and an important article in California Sunday Magazine about Paradise, California, called Simply Gone. Thanks again for being with us, Mark.
I appreciate it. You take care.